Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Oscar Hijuelos, who became the first Latino to be awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1990 for his novel The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. He wrote rich and radiant novels that brought the Cuban-American immigrant experience to the heart of American literature, helping to open the doors for other Latino writers. The Library of America recently released a collection of Hijuelos' works that includes The Mambo Kings, as well as two other influential works, Our House in the Last World and Mr. Ives' Christmas. Today we are joined by the two editors of that collection. Laura Marie Carlson Hijuelos is an editor, translator, novelist, and the widow of Oscar Hijuelos. Laura P. Alonzo Gallo is a scholar of Latino, Caribbean, and Cuban-American fiction and professor of English at Barry University in Miami. Check out their detailed bios in the show notes to learn more. Lori and Laura are interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate at the American Writers Museum.
Thank you, Lori and Laura, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm looking forward to talking with you more about Oscar Hijuelos and his work, his legacy, what he's meant to you personally. So I think we'll start off, if you don't mind, introducing yourselves to our listeners a little bit. Tell me a little bit about yourself, what you've been up to, and how you first encountered Oscar Hijuelos' work. Lori, perhaps we can start with you.
Most recently, I've been thinking a lot about the publicity for a new book I have coming out in October, which is for young adults called A Path to the World. And it's an anthology primarily directed toward teens regarding civics and ethics. But more importantly, my time is devoted to my husband's estate. And among the myriad issues of that estate is the most pressing concern, which is my husband's archives. I've been trying to locate an appropriate home, a university setting, and it's been more difficult than I had anticipated for various reasons. But mainly, I'm dealing with my husband's estate. It's a difficult one. It's a complex one. As to how Oscar and I met, our relationship began in 1981 when I left graduate school and started working for a Rockefeller organization called the Center for Inter-American Relations on Park Avenue, and it was a very tony, sophisticated place for mainly North American businessmen, artists, Latin American artists, philanthropists, political scientists, public affairs speakers, to engage with Latin American nations. And Oscar was one of many young writers at the time he had not published to come and feel camaraderie. And because I was hosting the receptions in the evening, I was able to engage with so many people of so many walks of life. And Oscar was introduced to me by a wonderful Guatemalan writer named David Unger. So that is how I met my husband.
Oh, that's great. That's a great story. Laura, how about you? What can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been up to?
Well, I think it's important to say that I was born, raised, and educated in Spain, although I did most of my doctoral work in the United States. I became professor of youth literature in the south of Spain, and in 2002, I relocated in Miami, where I have been teaching all this long. In 2012, I earned my tenure at Barry University, where I also serve as chair of the Department of English and Foreign Languages. And I pride in sharing the joy of literature and the humanities with a diverse community of students. My scholarly work concentrates on contemporary fiction, mainly by Latino and Latina writers. Although I have also published criticism on other American writers, often using a comparative universalist approach. I think it's important to say that Wiley Blackwell's Encyclopedia of Contemporary American Fiction, 1980-2020, recently published my entry on Oscar Hijuelos, for which I reread with much pleasure all his novels, 8 in total, and his memoir, Thoughts Without Cigarettes. I'm currently working on an article that analyzes contemporary short stories under the light of the philosophy of Byung-Chul Han, who sees that a society of technology, self-reference, and speediness is not only altering human relations and desires, but also promoting isolation and narcissism, among other things. So that's what I'm working on currently. How I first encountered Oscar Hijuelos and his work. Well, this is a funny story or a curious story. I was a young student doing research for my PhD dissertation at Duke University in 1989. Well, I devoted my doctoral work to the novels of John Updike. I also taught advanced courses of Spanish for the Department of Romance Studies. I was an avid reader. I still are. While at Duke, I discovered works by American writers of Hispanic descent. In fall of 1989, I saw this thick book in the bookstore in the Bryan Center. The cover was colorful and the title was just phenomenal. Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. It seemed like a very intelligent paradox to me because of the distance between the mambo, which is seduction, right? And the love song or bolero, which is more romantic. Oscar Hijuelos, the name hit me. I thought, what a great name. I read the novel. I cherished it. I enjoyed it very much. It transported me to many different places. It really appealed to me as a Spaniard, as someone who loves Cuba, its history, and Cuban people, as a reader of good books, regardless the nationality of their authors, and as a student of new literary texts and techniques. So that is how I encountered Oscar Hijuelos.
That's a great story too. I love that. I've been reading the Mambo Kings as well in preparation for this, and I agree with you. And I obviously relate to it in a different way than you, I feel it's one of those stories, one of those books where I feel like I'm right there. In each scene he describes. I wanted to backtrack a little bit talk a little bit more about Oscar Hijuelos and his upbringing. He was born in New York City in the States, but his parents were from Cuba. I'm curious if either of you have any insights into what that sort of upbringing meant to him and how that impacted him, like, both personally and as a writer. Because I was also in my research learned that he, as a kid, had a really serious illness that kept him in a hospital for almost a year, and he sort of lost his Spanish, but became fluent in English during that time. So I'm just curious about that that sort of duality of his upbringing as you know, being born in America, but then also having the Cuban heritage. So Lori, perhaps you could speak to some of that and how that impacted him as both, you know, personally and as a writer?
Sure. Oscar was born at St. Luke's Hospital on Columbia University's campus And he was raised on West 118th Street, which is on Columbia's campus. And his mother brought Oscar and his brother, Pascual, to Holguín to meet Magda's family when Oscar was 4. And during that time, Oscar contracted nephritis. His family never knew if it was from water or if it was from the sea or if he had eaten something. But nevertheless, when he got back to New York City, he became extremely ill. In those years, an immigrant household, such as Oscar's, with little facility in English, did not have the ability to advocate for itself. So when Oscar was put in the hospital, against his family's wishes, he was sent to a convalescent home, and he never found out where that home was until he researched for his memoir. We discovered it was Greenwich, Connecticut, and Oscar was in that facility for a little over a year. As he recounts it, especially as he recounted it to me, he saw many children die because most of these children were extremely ill. When Oscar got back home, he was either frightened or limited in his ability to speak Spanish because the nursing staff and the doctors were forcing him to answer in English. They didn't understand Spanish, so he probably was learning from the other children. And because he was still very ill and his mother was very protective, he had to stay home for another 2-3 years before he was able to mix with other children. And during that time, it's my belief, and I think it was Oscar's too, that Magda's influence on him was so great that it lasted forever and affected his writing. So Magdalena was a very poetic soul and a very flamboyant woman. She loved to talk and tell stories. And these stories were not simple stories. They were a blend of myth and imagination and her feelings about being in New York City. And they went on and on and on. As many Spanish-speaking people do, their communication, their discourse is not confined. It's not limited in a way that English speakers are taught to be cogent, to be direct, to get to the point. She never spoke that way. And I believe that is what influenced Oscar's writing, the way she spoke in flourish, in long drawn out sentences, and one story blending into another and another. So he was pretty much protected because he was staying at home a little bit more than he should have. And they were not encouraging him to speak in Spanish. So they were learning English from Oscar at the same time because he was answering in English. I don't think Oscar ever lost his Spanish, to be honest with you. I think he was frightened to speak Spanish. But throughout his life, he was able to speak Spanish, especially when he was relaxed. And I can tell you, as his wife, in his sleep, he sounded like an old Cubano. He would go on and on and on in Spanish. So I know, and it was authentic with Cuban aphorisms and Cubanismos. Mm. So yeah, I don't think he really ever lost his Spanish.
Yeah, you make a good point, too, of how he was like you said, perhaps afraid to use his Spanish because, as he was in that hospital, he was told not to do that, basically. So, yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yes, I remember in his memoirs, he mentioned to be, I don't remember if he uses the word traumatized, but there was a certain nurse, right, Lori, who basically commanded him to speak only English. And I don't remember if she punished him by putting him in a closet, a dark room. So I think that in his mind, and according to his memoirs, he associated Spanish with something that was not good or not good enough or not authorized or something like that.
It's very interesting, that story about the closet, because a week ago I was listening to some of the interviews Oscar gave with Charlie Rose. And Charlie asked him about that incident, and Oscar admitted that it was probably made up, that it was a conceit. But in his mind, he was feeling so punished that, and he always had a very unusual relationship with closets. He built museums in closets. He built tableaus in closets. Closets became a very symbolic space for Oscar. But he does admit to Charlie that he probably made that story up. Being the novelist that he was.
Right.
Yeah, Oscar fictionalized a lot of things.
Of course he did. Of course he did. He was entitled.
Yes.
So I wanted to talk about the, speaking of his fiction, the new Library of America collection that's coming out, I believe, the 13th of September, that you both were the editors for. I'm curious if you want to share what that editing process was like, how the collection sort of came about.
Let me just very quickly say that, first of all, I was honored that Lori asked me to be part of this edition, honored with all the letters of that word. And it meant a lot to me because I had been publishing about Oscar Hijuelos and in relation to other Cuban American writers and other writers in general, because I consider him a master and a classic. And so it was a gift. And for me personally, the editing process was a pleasure. Working with Lori was easy, an exciting and a very humbling experience. I remember when I started working on the chronology of Oscar Hijuelos, which the Library of America had asked Lori and me to include in the special edition of these three novels. It's on the final pages of the edition. Wow, it was as if I had been invited to travel through Hijuelos' childhood, young years, college life, adult life, as a quiet guest. I read his memoirs, his interviews. I often asked Lori for details, for clarification in dates and events. She was always so generous with me. My journey into Hijuelos' life was a treat. I felt his isolation growing up and his loneliness in certain years, his insecurities about becoming a writer, his vitality and his excitement when he received the Pulitzer Prize and visited Spain and lived in Italy. I understood his spirituality. The more notes I took, the more I wanted to know. I was impacted through his memoirs and interviews and Lori's stories by his humbleness, by his kind and warm personality. I wrote many pages, many more words than we had been asked to submit. Lori did an excellent job in editing the chronology and selecting the essential.
Thank you, Laura. The way this edition came about is the following. I asked my agent if she would reach out to the Library of America because I felt Oscar should definitely be among the canon, their library, being who he was and what he did for American Letters, which was to open up opportunities for writers of Latin American background who had never had a chance to be published by New York City publishers, let me put it that way. There were small houses in the Southwest, for instance, a few houses on the East Coast. I remember one in New Jersey, one in Pennsylvania, that published a few authors every other year or so. And Jennifer reached out to the Library of America. One of the editors there said, "Oh, wow, yeah, I've taught Oscar at Rutgers. I've taught Oscar here. He'd be marvelous as part of this collection." So that was the origin of the volume. And when they asked if I would edit it, because I'm so involved with diverse aspects of his estate, television shows, musicals, his collections, the legal aspects, it's enormous. I recalled having read Lauda's superb entry, encyclopedic entry, and thought she would be the perfect companion to edit this volume with me. And she graciously accepted. It was nothing but joy for both of us. We got along immediately from the get-go. We worked beautifully together. There was a certain rhythm to our collaboration, right, Laura?
Yes, completely. It was a perfect match.
It really was. It's been a splendid time, to be honest with you.
Indeed.
Now, we didn't choose the novels. The novels were chosen by the editorial staff at Library of America. But I think they did a pretty good job. These are excellent novels and different in their ways. They represent to me the various facets of Oscar's corpus, because Oscar was a deeply spiritual, even religious man, which many people don't know. He was a man who lived by music and loved music. Music was everything to my husband. And then you have Our House in the Last World, which is about family, which is also a major theme in all of Oscar's work. So they chose a novel that is religious, a novel that is familial, and a novel that is musical. Those three elements are in every single one of Oscar's novels. Mm-hmm. They represent his personality and his writing style.
I agree. It's an excellent choice. Yes, as a critic, I second that.
That brings up a question I was curious about, and that is more on the sort of literary approach to his work. Are there any certain styles or voice that is distinctly Oscar's that you can pinpoint, or perhaps you kind of mentioned it just now, Lori, but a sort of any sort of through line that you can pull throughout his body of work, that any sort of overall themes that are, if you read it, you're like, oh, that's definitely Oscar de Quillos.
Laura, I'll let you answer that first and then I'll weigh in.
Right. Yes, I can talk about a few features that are definitely Oscar Hijuelos, the way he managed different techniques, and also his personal seal that appears in all novels, all narratives. I would like to mention his distinct use of memory and his distinct use of nostalgia. I think he uses memory much in the fashion of the French writer Marcel Proust. I think memory permeates his fiction, and like the French writer Proust, characters do not travel from present to past, but from past to present, meaning from memory to perception. Pretty much following Henri Bergson's philosophy, he understood this as a sensual epiphany. So it's the past constantly gravitating over the present in his works. And somehow the past brings comfort and brings hope into the present. May sound like a paradox, but I find that very clear in all his novels. Then is the nostalgia. I think he expresses nostalgia both in the uprootedness from Cuba and the loss of a kinder past. So Cuba or not Cuba, there's always that nostalgia for a kinder past. Nostalgia becomes an instrument in his aesthetics to, I think, reimagine either the Cuban past or a universal innocence. A universal innocent past that was good. That, I think, those two elements became his seal, conscious or unconscious, but his seal. I know that he liked to call himself a lyrical realist, and he was. He liked to invest in characterization. He preferred the third-person narrators that helped characters digress in time and subject matter. But he was never a moralist like the realists. He did not condemn his characters' vices and flaws. He also brought to his fiction many different eras, and we find in the narrative the idiom, the mannerisms, the fashion, the people of those eras, public and private people. And I also think of him as a modernist and as a postmodernist in techniques such as magic realism, which he uses in very specific for very specific purposes, the structure of the story, how he structured his stories is modernist, but he is also advancing towards postmodernism. And the use of footnotes, so just like T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland in 1922, the modernist poem par excellence. Popular culture he includes, and musical rhythms. All of that make him, you know, a modernist and a postmodernist writer.
It's on point. Perfectly said, accurate to the nth degree. I can't add anything to that.
Thank you, Laurie. You're too good.
It's perfect. Because everything you said is absolutely correct and accurate. And you're right about the nostalgic aspect of his work. If you remember, one of his titles, A Simple of On a Melody, as a subtitle.
Correct.
When the World Was Good.
Exactly.
And Oscar was often thinking about the past as a better place, always, yes.
Yeah, I noticed that in the, like I said, I've been reading the Mambo Kings, and there's a passage where he, many passages, I'm sure, but one that's sticking out is describing how he used to be able to walk down 118th Street, I think, and walk into the Central Park and not have to worry about any sort of violence or crime or anything. Yeah, and even the Mambo Kings itself is a whole, the story is Cesar reminiscing basically in this in his hotel room towards the end of his life, I don't know, as you were saying that, it made me, got me thinking about, like, you know, now that this Library of America collection is coming out, he's getting his proper spot in the canon. Like, what sort of nostalgia do you have about Oscar Iquelos himself and his work?
Well, if you're asking me that question, I'm flooded with memories. I couldn't even begin to select or cull a particular memory or memories, because my life now is a kaleidoscope of the past of my life with Oscar. It's every day when I wake up, I'm thinking about my life with Oscar. It's not really in memory so much as a flood, a sea of experience that I miss from morning to night. Nostalgia, I suppose. Christmas is a very, very difficult time for me, because Christmas was Oscar's favorite time of year. It is my favorite time of year. I miss all the rituals that we had at Christmas. Oscar made sure that we would always go shopping and have a beautiful lunch at a very fancy restaurant to break up the marathon of purchasing. And then we would go to Rockefeller Center to look at the tree and walk back to the apartment along Fifth Avenue, along Madison Avenue, till we got to the Upper West Side. We would park our gifts, and then we would go pick a tree. And then we would listen to Bach, which was, Bach was Oscar's favorite composer. And all that life is gone for me now. So I would relegate Christmas to nostalgia.
I would like to emphasize for our audience that nostalgia is there, and he used it in this marvelous way. But there's also, don't forget, the use of memory, the way he transports characters to their memories, to their past, and how, as I said, that past gravitates over the present, and how the past brings hope. We normally think of the future as hopeful, right? No, it's the past that brings hope because of that nostalgia, because that there was a time that in the past that was happy, that meant happiness and that meant goodness. So it's very important to remember that both things come along in his fiction, and that I see that use of memory, the technique, that the way he uses memory and nostalgia are, you know, part of his aesthetics. Very powerful, much in the way of Marcel Proust.
Yeah, that's a good distinction, important distinction to make. And you just mentioned Marcel Proust again. I was curious if either of you are aware of any writers that Oscar liked to read, and any sort of literary influences that if you see that in his writing, or Laura, you might have some personal insights into that as well. I'm always curious to see who the writers are reading, you know.
Oscar's favorite novelist was Jorge Luis Borges. Mm-hmm. He also loved Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Those two Latin American novelists were the most influential on Oscar as a writer. He enjoyed writers of the past more than he enjoyed contemporary novelists. So one of his favorite novelists was the Swede Per Lagerfeld, who wrote Barabbas. I don't know if you've ever read that novel. He loved Marguerite Yourcenar, Memoirs mm-hmm. of Adrian.
Yes.
One of his very favorite books. He liked D.H. Lawrence, John Hersey, Italo Calvino. Mm-hmm. If I had to choose some contemporary writers, I'd say Michael Ondaatje, he thought was marvelous. Toni Morrison. He liked a British writer few readers know, at least in this country, named Jim Crace. He liked poetry, Delmore Schwartz, for instance. He liked Jamaica Kincaid. He thought she was wonderful. So those are some of the writers Oscar would appreciate. He was influenced a lot by, let's say, Charles Dickens. He loved Dickens. And whenever we were in London, we always visited the Dickens house. He liked to go through. And Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. Mark Twain was an enormous, enormous influence on Oscar. So those are some of the writers I would identify as being influential on Oscar's work.
I remember learning a lot about his taste in the memoir, in his memoir, and also in an interview that I conducted, and he was, you know, very generous, telling me all about his literary taste and very humble. Of course, he loved Charles Dickens, but he did not know, he was unaware that he had a strong influence from him. Mm-hmm. I think he was not aware of that. So as a critic, I see the realist style of the British writers Dickens and Thomas Hardy. I think that his works display the brilliance of their prose. As well as their attention to detail and the elegant narrative discourse of these writers, the clever characterization. Hardy was a realist, but had a romantic twist that can be found in Ihuelos's narratives. That's why he liked to identify himself as a lyrical realist. However, I see Ihuelos as a realist that examined and reflected upon social realities, but I think I mentioned this earlier, he did not seek to criticize. He did not seek to change society's morals. And vices, but to contemplate who we are, the human soul, right? I also see Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn in his preference for the vernacular in certain characters, not only it's very obvious in the book, the novel, young adult novel, Dark Dude, 2008, great novel. I mean, somebody who enjoys literature is going to find Huckleberry Finn as a young Cuban boy in New York in contemporary times. So that novel is, you know, so Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn. I see E.L. Doctorow in his interest in history. And is in interest in small stories of people intertwined with history, with a bigger history, right? History of a nation, history of a community. I find that in some books, there is the style of magic realism that, as we all know, characterized Hispanic writers of the so-called Latin American boom. Lori has mentioned Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Nobel Prize. I also see Isabel Allende in his use of magic realism. He uses magic realism differently from Gabriel García Márquez, but the discourse is very similar. He uses it when his characters must deal with the death of someone special, a father, a husband, a brother. And with this technique, I think he expresses communication. He expresses spiritual connection. I think that through magic realism, he gets he gives his characters the opportunity to find peace in a place that is partly memory and partly desire. I also somehow detect some influence from Guillermo Cabrera Infante, the Cuban writer, and D.H. Lawrence in his explicit expressions of sexuality, with which Hijuelos, I would say masterfully, gives life to some of his characters' consciousness. So I find other influences, but that is my perspective as a critic.
It's very interesting, if I can interject and question here. Several critics have brought up this idea that Oscar used magical realism in his work, which I find fascinating. And I think he would too, because I don't think Oscar ever thought that he was employing elements of magical realism ever. You're not the first critic or the last critic to mention Isabel Allende. Oscar, I know for a fact, never read Isabel Allende. I happen to have known Isabel when she wrote Our House because I was involved in finding a translator for that book. Her editor at the time, Lee Gerner, came to me and asked if I would help him. And so Isabel and I became friendly. I read Isabel, but Oscar never did. I'm curious what elements, or if you can remember passages that you think of as pertaining to magical realism, because it may be that Oscar himself experienced these very unusual spiritual, out of the norm events. So, and because I know he did, I'm curious what you think of as magical realism in his work. He would never, ever have said that of his work.
Okay. Yes. And that, I think that's a great question and topic. Okay. So you see magic realism in Our House in the Last World, the first novel. Maybe he did not intentionally want to use magic realism as a technique, but it became natural in him. I mean, it came out naturally. When Mercedes has lost Alejo. So the Cuban mother figure, right, in the novel, has lost her husband, Alejo, who's a very powerful figure, character in this novel, powerful man, a magnetic personality, abusive, but a great friend of friends, generous, enthusiastic, hardworking person, not ambitious. So he dies, and she has many reproaches. She has a lot of complaints. And what we see is Mercedes dreaming and daydreaming and falling asleep and remembering all of that, you know, together. And she is talking to him and she is seeing him visiting her. And she talks to him. So what we see here is Mercedes wanting to make peace with her husband. What we see here is that she loved him dearly. in spite of it all, in spite of the abuse, of, you know, verbal abuse, then him not being ambitious for his family, him not being around when he was needed, you know, when his presence was needed, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the, as I said, this is the way this character Mercedes finds peace. And where does she find that peace? Not in the real world, but in this magic world of her imagination, memory, daydreaming, sleep, that is partly memory and partly desire. We also have that in Mambo Kings. We have that in other novels. Well, in Mr. Ives' Christmas, of course.
Well, what makes you think that without betraying confidences, because I tread a very careful path here, and I know the family, I knew the family, I still know the family, that what you're interpreting as magical realism wasn't real. In other words, I know what you're alluding to in Mr. Ives' Christmas, the episode when Ives walks out on Madison Avenue and he sees something in the sky, all of these winds and colors and this and that. Oscar actually had these kinds of experiences. They were not made up. They were not imaginary. Mm-hmm. He realized these experiences. He had them. His mother, well, once again, I have to be very careful here because I'm a discreet person and I'm a member of the family. But what you're thinking of as something out of the ordinary just might have been ordinary. It's an insight that I want to leave with you, because many times people who are reading a novel don't understand the origin of the episode in its proper context as being something that perhaps had been experienced. Oscar, this brings up an interesting facet of Oscar's personality. He was not a usual man. My husband was an exceedingly spiritual man, and he had highly unusual engagements with what we call reality that many people never have. And this was also true of his mother. Oscar was able to see things in ways that people could not see. And he had some travels in which he experienced such unusual events that he could barely describe them to me. He did, and he made me promise I would never relate them to anyone. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really, it's interesting from a literary perspective, and a critic, of course, has the right to interpret a work of art or a work of literature as he or she sees fit, but I'm just trying to lend a little playfulness here, because Oscar was a highly unusual man who experienced life on planes that 99.9% of human beings do not. Not to be provocative, but
no, I think I mean, this speaks, I mean, this says a lot about the way he wrote, and I don't think we disagree. Yeah. I mean, magic realism is a very ample term. And it can be a genre, but it can also be a technique. So the fantasy and the dreamy stuff, the stuff of dreams, the fantasy, the sort of spiritual elements that inhabit somebody's subconsciousness are there. He brings them up in certain characters. And the way I see it is that because the reason is because those characters need to communicate with the person who has passed away. And they talk to them as if they were alive, but also at the same time as if they were dead. So it's a mix. The way he uses this technique, maybe he was not aware he was using magic realism, but I guess anybody who reads it is going to detect that, because it's not the real picture of reality. It's in the mind of the character mixed with sleep, with dream, with nightmare, with desire. It's all together. And I think it's just about finding communication, about making peace with the person that is gone, or with in Mr. Ives' Christmas is about finding reasons why, right?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I listening to you two have this discussion. It could almost be its own separate full episode about what is realism and magic realism and who gets to decide that too. And it's as I've been listening, it's interesting to me. In a way, it's almost like Laura, what you were saying about his writing, to me sounds a lot like what Lori, what you were saying about himself as being an unusual person. It's almost like he, you know, the reader's, you know, assessment of his work is to me almost seems to encapsulate who he was as a person as well, like kind of bringing all those elements of his life. And I also love describing him, as you did, Lori, as an unusual person. I think that's a great term, and really says a lot with just one word. This has been fascinating, and it's got me thinking too about imaginations and things like that. And my next question is one that I always like to ask, and it will take some imagination on our part. But if Oscar were alive today, how do you think he'd be interacting with our world? And he only died in 2013, I believe, but a lot has changed since then. So Lori, you might perhaps have some good insights into this question as to how do you think he'd be, doing nowadays?
Well, Laura has mentioned some attributes of Oscar's personality and his writing style that are so perfectly true. And they relate to how I would describe his interaction if he were to be alive today. Oscar he accepted life on its terms. He did not judge his characters. Laura, you're absolutely right. He often said, a good novelist has to have compassion for his characters. He has to love his characters with all of their flaws and all of their weaknesses. He was not a moralistic man. He presented the world as he saw it. He was not a politically correct man either. He was someone who would be incredibly sorrowful and disheartened by what he would see today. I've often thought about this, actually, Nate. How would Oscar respond to all of these things that are happening? He might not have engaged in the way that some novelists do, in the sense that they use 9/11 or they will use a tragedy or a world event as a theme for a novel. Oscar would not have done that. the terrible atrocities that we're seeing today in Ukraine, or any number of sadnesses that are happening in the world, would have affected him on a profound level and would have come out in a different way in a novel of his making. But he would not have chosen any number of, let's say, historical events today, or events that are current events, let's say, to make a novel of those current events. That was mm-hmm. not his style. Oscar was not a political man.
He was not.
No. He had political views, but that was not, his raison d'etre was not to be a writer who expressed political feelings in his novels. That's just not part of his composition. I know that he would have been deeply saddened by what is happening. That I can say. And he might have written a few editorials for the New York Times. That he might have done. Laura, sorry.
No, don't. I agree with everything, and that's the way I feel he's writing. I absolutely agree. He's not political in his in the way he tells stories within a bigger history. Let me give everybody a beautiful quotation from A Simple Havana Melody, published in 2002, from When the World Was Good, that Laurie mentioned earlier. This book is a book about a musician, a fantastic, wonderful, talented musician, Cuban, who happens to be in Europe, travels to Europe, he travels to New York too, and you know, in the novel, most of the novel is when he travels to Europe and he finds himself in the middle of the Second World War. And his last name, Levis, is taken as a Jewish name. It's a Jewish name, but he was very Catholic. So, you know, he is taken by the Germans, let's say, and put in a concentration camp. And he suffers. He doesn't suffer the same fate that most Jewish people in concentration camps felt. But he witnesses this terrible part of history. And this is what he says in the novel. And this is one of my favorite quotations. What most tormented him was the violation of his belief that goodness would prevail upon evil in the world. The violation of his belief. So that is, he does not talk about the Holocaust. He does not criticize, you know, explicitly, such as an Yale doctoral would do, politics. He does not talk about politics in Cuba too much. He talks about what happened in Cuba under Batista and under Castro in other novels, right, Laurie? But he does not get into the politics of it. Mm-hmm. And then I am, you know, very happy to learn what you said about what we're going through in our time. Ever since his passing, the world is going very fast. Technology is, you know, we live in a very rapid world. There's a lot of stress, and we don't have time to think and to sit and to reflect and to look at each other in the eyes, right? And you said that Oscar Hijuelos would not probably like that. What I can see him doing if he were with us today is, I can imagine him writing about a young generation of Americans immersed in the digital world and how they discover the meaning of neighbor's stories, the values of their aging grandparents, music as a connection between the generations. I think he would be into that, but maybe it's my imagination. I don't know. Laurie, what do you think?
What's so interesting, Laura, is when Nate asked us to choose a passage that we particularly liked from one of Oscar's novels, I also chose From a Simple Avada Melody. I chose the very last page and a few sentences on the next page. It's called A Simple Postscript, because that page and a few sentences following explain exactly who Oscar was as a writer. He was talking about Israel Levis, who is based on the famous Cuban composer Moises Simon. Oscar, I don't know that he would have, I suppose he might have written the kind of book you're describing if I had pushed him toward that direction. for a young adult book. He wrote Dark Dude because I asked him to write Dark Dude. He would never have written a YA novel otherwise. It was only because I kind of forced him to.
It's an excellent book. I mean, it's just such a beautiful voice. That Rico, I love that character and his what happens to him.
I don't know, honestly. We can't really say what Oscar would have written. I do know that he was continuing to work on a mammoth, massive novel that he entitled Blue Antiquity, which is the culmination of Oscar's worldview, really. It's his cosmography. It's so interesting. Since Oscar's death, I've had to go through hundreds and hundreds of boxes containing all sorts of things that he was collecting on the sly. He wasn't telling me about purchasing all of these things. And what I found were dozens and dozens of icons, iconography relating to religion, to saints, to the Holy Family. He was working on this book about archaeology, the beginnings of time, spirituality, Jesus Christ. I don't really know in what direction he would have gone after that. I really don't. But Oscar's interest tended to be those that were not contemporary interests. He liked things that related, as Lotta was saying, to the past. He was always thinking about the past. And I really don't know that he would have found himself in the middle of today's reality, grasping what was happening as a theme for a novel. He may have, I just don't know.
I mean, it's hard to say.
Yeah, Laurie, did you want to read that passage that you brought up or?
What I would like to do is read the last page of A Simple Avada Melody, because in a nutshell, it describes in a way how Oscar related to the genesis of each of his novels, except that he is speaking in the voice of Israel Levis.
Okay.
How was it that I came to write the music for Rosas Puras? It is better to speak first about how it is to compose any piece of music. This process begins with a recollection of notes that may have come to you out of the very air, or out of a dream, or even from one's memory of the tone of a voice during a conversation. Or it begins with the imagining of a lullaby or a child's song from youth. A few notes that for some reason have stayed with you, though slightly transformed by what Sigmund Freud calls the unconscious mind. Or you have discerned a certain pattern in the music of birds, or hear a unique harmony in the ringing of church bells, both of which were very important to Oscar. These resonate and somehow remain with you when you sit down before the piano, trying to make sense of these sounds in your mind. I usually get my ideas by hearing them first in my head, and then I whistle the melody or line and therefore bring it out roughly into the world. But sitting down before a piano changes everything. Those notes come and you place them in the context of chords, which add harmonies. And in doing so, your mind is always changed, and slowly it comes. Something new, something pleasing. That is my hope anyway. I can write with lyrics, but I most often prefer to compose the music first and then present this to a clever wordsmith like my dear friend, Manny Cortez. Though I always imply the idea, I say, Manny, this is going to be a song about the trolleys, or this is music about a girl who sees an apparition of the Virgin. Whatever. That was the case with Rosas Puras. I had a melody that came instantly to me, arranged with the assistance of that unseen and underappreciated inspiration, which can only come from God.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, it's an excellent passage. I remember reading and rereading it.
Mm-hmm. Right, so I wanted to wrap this up, but I wanted to, was there anything else that we didn't cover that either of you wanted to talk about for a little bit?
I think we should not forget to mention that Oscar Hijuelos opened a big door in 1990. Lori was talking about that earlier, but I don't think she went too much into the detail of how Hispanic writers, Latino writers, Latinx writers, however you want to call them, really, you know, started to be heard and started to be published in main publishing houses. I mean, we're talking about Cristina Garcia, Francisco Goldman, Sandra Cisneros, and Julia Alvarez, and then of course, you know, younger generations like Junot Diaz, etc., etc. So it is very important to remember that. There's this interview in in Publishers Weekly where Oscar Hijuelos is saying, "I remember being told when the novel came out," he's talking about Mambo Kings, "minority novels don't sell, period. That's why you hear if you're Hispanic," he said, he added. "Punto. Forget it, baby." But the Mambo Kings enjoyed strong support from its publishers and by 1991 had more than 200,000 copies in print. And then it was translated into different languages, various languages. So it is very important to understand that the Pulitzer Prize in 1990 had incredibly brilliant writers as finalists. And the prize, the award went to him. I think this is very important. I mean, this is we have to honor his talent here, and the way he opened that door to new voices, Latino voices, Hispanic writers that had been publishing for over 150 years in very small, community in their communities, right? And then I would like to, I mean, you can tell I'm a passionate of Ascari Huelos. I would like to just say, I think Nate, you talked about why Ascari Huelos' writing makes it so enduring and so relevant today. And I think I would like to give like three reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I think that through his characters, he invites us to engage in timeless existential questions that relate to human identity, to mortality, to family bonding, to friendship, the art of friendship, to loneliness, to success. So we have those timeless existential questions. Secondly, because in his fiction, he interweaves socio-political history of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century with urban life, with music, with popular culture, with art, which could be music, architecture, whatever it is, painting, and popular culture. That's very, very good, and it's so relevant, you know. And then lastly, in his writing, I think we always discover the terrible fate that human beings face. He tells us these stories, and the way historical forces make people suffer and fall. But in Huelos's writing, we also discover the power of art and the power of love, both hand in hand. There's always art and there's always love. And I think what Laurie read, that passage from A Simple Havana Melody, is about that. How art, music in this case, creativity, composing, your aesthetics, your vocation, saves you from that, you know, terrible fate, if you want. You know, I just wanted to finish with that, with those three reasons why we should read Ascari Huelos and why he is a classic.
And I would like to add one thing. And this is one of my missions. To make certain that Oscar is remembered as an American novelist.
Hmm.
Not a Cuban-American novelist. An American novelist. Born and raised in New York City of Cuban parentage, an American novelist.
Yeah, I like that.
We can consider the Mambo Kings play Song of Love as the great American novel, one of the great American novels, mm-hmm. right? And we can situate him like Philip Roth in the canon, like John Updike in the canon, like Polly Marshall in the canon. So I agree with what Laurie says. Cuban or not Cuban, his characters are pose those existential questions that are timeless.
Thank you. That's well said. That is an important distinction to make too, that no matter where his parents were from, you know, he's an American novelist. And I have really enjoyed learning more about him and reading him during the research leading up to this, and then even more during this conversation. I really, really fascinating stuff, and can't wait to think about more about magical realism for the rest of the, rest of the day. But Laurie and Laura, thank you again for joining me. I truly enjoyed this conversation.
It was Thanks. A lot of fun.
It was. Yeah. Thank you, Nate, for helping us organize our thoughts and inviting us to share so many wonderful things. There's a lot more to say, but I guess that we should just encourage people to read those three novels that are very different from each other, and you know, maybe have a further conversations and discussions about them.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nate. Thank you, Laura, for your generosity. It means so much to me, and I know that Oscar senses this.
Love that.
Yeah. I'm so happy and proud and honored to be in this edition. So thank you so much, and until next one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Have a nice evening, everyone.
You too. Have a nice evening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Nation of Writers Podcast, part of the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening. And to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.